Last week, following the outrage expressed by people in cities across the country and around the world at the abuse of power evidenced in the video of the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis, we reached out to several members of the faculty here at UTC, asking them to help all of us put the events of the moment in historical context. Our guest this afternoon is Dr. Darrell Walsh. Dr. Walsh is a sociologist with a particular interest in economic and racial inequality. What are your thoughts on what happened in Minneapolis?
Well, I first appreciate the invitation to have this conversation. I think it's important to have serious dialogue. And from a social science perspective, there is a significant amount of social science scholarship that examines human behavior in society. And those of us who spend our careers putting society under microscope, we offer really, I think, one explanation. What we see happening has to do with systemic inequity, which is socially created. And we as citizens have created these social ills. And we as citizens can effectively respond to what is happening in society by just simply undoing what we have done. We created the social ills, and so we can undo the social ills. We have to have the political will to do so. I'd like to first sort of reflect back on an incident that happened, especially with a particular protest. And I want to raise a few questions to the listening audience. The NFL football player Colin Kaepernick protested peacefully. And here's my question to listeners and people who are analyzing what's going on. When he did what he did, taking a knee, what was your reaction to Colin Kaepernick's protesting about an injustice? Did you support it, or did you oppose this method? In your mind, was he considered patriotic or unpatriotic? And when we put this under the microscope and we look around the world and other countries and we see people, citizens, rising up against what they see as an injustice, what we know in our society is he was executing his civic responsibility. He was bringing light to an injustice. He was speaking out. And so when you ask me the question, sometimes I always ask, when people oppose Colin Kaepernick's position, he was doing a peaceful protest. And then here we see an injustice that happened, and yet now people are outraged and they are protesting. And before I move on, I want to just sort of put this in another context. I want to illustrate. I think a lot of times people can relate to this. Parents. And I believe all listeners can relate to this scenario. And this, too, can, I think, be tied to personal responsibility. As parents, are you teaching your child to protest, speak up, and speak out? So when you tell your kids how to handle an injustice at school from another child, you tell your little girl, you tell your little boy that they should tell the teacher. And you, as a parent, expect the teacher to do something about the injustice. As a parent, when you see an injustice committed against your child, you use the chain of command. You approach the teacher. If there's no satisfactory resolution, you go to the principal. You use the appropriate chain of command to address the grievance experienced by your child. And some people skip the principal and they go directly to the superintendent of the school. But when I talk about that, here's my point. You expect the injustice to be corrected. You rally the support of other parents whose kids have experienced injustice and unfairness. You seek out anybody else who will validate your grievance of injustice committed against your precious little girl or little boy or your grandchild. The bottom line is this. You acted. You executed protest when you saw and experienced injustice. So, Richard, yes, indeed, what we see, the anger, and when we see the outrage following the death of Mr. George Floyd in Minneapolis, it has been expressed in riots across the country. But here is the ultimate solution. As a country, we as citizens have a moral obligation to rectify the systemic, negative, differential treatment committed toward other citizens. And each of us have personal responsibility. The responsibility to correct the blatant injustice. Any American citizen who sees that video and is not moved to act, to correct our system in order that it will never happen again is wrong. Your silence and your inaction is contributing to the problem of injustice. And as a nation, I think that those of us who believe all men and women are created in the image of God, we believe all human beings have inalienable rights endowed by the Creator, and we are a nation that believes in democracy. When we have citizens that subscribe to Judeo-Christian traditions, we are believers, men and women of faith. We teach our kids, admonishing them to follow the golden rule, do unto others as you would like others to do unto you. And I mean, we can choose to do what is right, or we can choose to do what is wrong. And we, as citizens, already know the rule about how we are supposed to treat each other. We all absolutely, completely understand and acknowledge the sin of murder. And what we saw, police officer Derek Chauvin applied extreme differential treatment towards Mr. George Floyd. Officer Chauvin murdered Mr. Floyd. There is no excuse for his actions in taking the life of Mr. Floyd. And the other officers stood by and they watched. They did nothing. They were not moved. They didn't feel compelled to say, stop that. That's not right. You're hurting him. That's enough. So for listeners, Richard, many of the people, I think, the listening audience, if they're interested in why this is happening, when they watch the news and they see the people protesting, and many of them might want to know how we as a society, how can we effectively respond? And I think in our nation, approximately a week ago, we all witnessed a murder in broad daylight. The onlookers in the aftermath are asking, well, what is going to be done to this obvious criminal act? Everyone is expecting swift justice. When the world watched such an inhumane act and they witnessed no response or a slow response to injustice, Richard, what I'm saying, people who saw the act as wrong, what did they do? They responded. They collectively started a protest. They mobilized and they conducted their civic responsibility. And for the listening audience who are searching for an explanation of why people are doing, the reason why the people, they are taken to the streets and they are screaming, no justice, no peace. They are responding to injustice. When we put this under sociological terms and we analyze, there's a lot of social movement scholars, and we talk about what moves people to protest. My question is always to those who are not joining the peaceful protest, where is your civic responsibility in reacting to injustice? We see these events happening, and they continue to happen. We're all at fault because we have not acted to the injustice. And you can protest in different ways.
You referenced the football player, Colin Kaepernick, going down on one knee. In my mind, that has become a powerful symbol. It's an action that's been repeated many times since, and so many times it seems in our culture that we respond more to visuals than we do to words. It's also in the story that we are all told of the country that Rosa Parks refusing to sit in the back of the bus was a tipping point. It was a moment when what had up to that point been accepted as the status quo was challenged, and ultimately it was overthrown. Do you see the death of Mr. Floyd as a symbol and also a tipping point?
Yes. And Richard, in the social science scholarship, we know that racial superiority is a myth. It's false. We understand race is a social construct. The notion of race was invented. It really doesn't matter about your skin pigmentation. Skin pigmentation is nothing more than what covers your body. What matters is the value that has been assigned to your skin pigmentation. It's how differentially how we're treated based on skin pigmentation. We rank order skin pigmentation. And America has a track record and a history of positively valuing and differentially treating white skin pigmentation while devaluing, differentially treating in a negative way Native Americans, Latino Americans, Asian Americans, and African Americans, people of color, non-white. So it's this notion of whiteness and white superiority that has plagued our country. And there is a huge degree of denial. And there are many, many American citizens who have tried to connect whiteness as godliness and dark pigmentation as a curse and have used this as a rational justification and have allowed bigotry and racial prejudice to persist. And this false assertion and this false understanding causes divisions. And it separates us as American citizens from the eternal light of the divine creator. And so I think you mentioned the tipping point. We're at a point where we have to, a political will. It's my hope is that our country will repent and turn away from our tendency to devalue other human beings based upon their skin pigmentation. You know, I would say that we go with these cycles. America was founded. We went through slavery. Following slavery, we had a huge war, civil war. After civil war, we thought we had repented. And then we went through Reconstruction. And then we went through the 60s, the Jim Crow systems. And we're still suffering from being an addict, a racial alcoholic. And I think our first step to the road of recovery is to admit it. We as a nation are in denial of being a racial alcoholic, if you will. So when Americans, when we start the conversation, we have to continue to attend meetings and have serious, uncomfortable conversations. When all Americans, regardless of race, come to the meeting for dialogue, we must admit, I am a racial alcoholic. We as a nation must seek atonement, and we must atone for the sins that have been levied against Native Americans, Asian Americans, Latino Americans, and African Americans. We basically must denounce racial and ethnic inequality. And we will always be in recovery because we have an ugly, dark history when it comes to non-white Americans' mistreatment and exclusion, especially when it comes to non-white racial groups having equal access to the valued resources in society. Now, in this current situation, we're talking about equal protection under the law. We talk about law and order, but we must have law and order that's going to be equally protecting all the citizens. And instead of inclusion, we see these exclusionary practices. We see institutional discriminatory practices in the judicial system, particularly the educational system, in the political system, the economic system, with jobs and pay. We see it in the housing industry and the banking industry related to mortgage and lending practices. These practices favorably include white Americans while excluding and creating implicit and explicit barriers for non-white American citizens. So I think in a nutshell, we're at another crossroad in America. In 2020, we have to repent. We have to confess the sin of racism. We have to ask for forgiveness for the sin of racism. And then after atonement, moving forward, we have to actually change our wicked ways. We have to be transparent in our policies that reflect the change. And that's where we are. And it's going to take all of us to acknowledge, to come together, to have some very uncomfortable, serious dialogue. And it's just like recovering from any kind of disease. We have to go to the meetings. We have to acknowledge that we have a problem, and we have to be transparent about the problem, and then we have to work to move forward to make sure that we can improve the problem. Once again, these social ills, they're socially created. Well, the positive part about it is they can be socially undone. We have to be honest and say enough is enough, and we want to do better.
It strikes me, listening to you, that and looking at what has been written and said over the decades, that this is a twin-pronged issue, that most people will sign off on that this is an ethical issue and it's wrong. almost everybody would agree that the ethics of this are indisputable. It's wrong. But then it becomes, and it seems to me that the foundation of it is an economic argument. And once you start talking about money, people seem to find ways to justify the most outrageous behavior because it results in profits, or conversely, in a loss of profits.
In the political campaigns, we keep hearing about the 5%. Most of the wealth is concentrated in the hands of a few individuals. And people challenge that, but sometimes that's very difficult for people to wrap their heads around. Because once again, you're very private about what your economic position is. And most of us who sort of, we run in social circles with people in our same economic class. But at the end of the day, when we think about when we take the census data, when we take some of the information that we collect, most Americans are in the same economic plight. There are people who are well above. I think what we see people protesting for, I think they're expressing a lot of different dimensions of their life that they're angry with. I mean, people are working 2 and 3 jobs. They're barely making ends meet. But then you see people that are making extraordinary amounts of money. And, you know, if you work for a certain company and you are making a significant contribution to the company, but the company is constantly making profits, yet when the company is doing real well, the company doesn't really want to share those profits with all the employees. But yet when there's some downturns, then the company wants to start trying to eliminate any type of benefits. They want to cut back on the hours and wages. And this is where people are also being frustrated, but they can't really find who to really protest against. And that's because I think, you know, economically, we don't really know where we stand. We just know that I'm living paycheck to paycheck, you know, and you might think about somebody else living paycheck to paycheck. So to your point, I want to, you know, class is the biggest issue, but it's these other issues that sort of people focus on. You know, we saw Occupy Wall Street, you know, that was where people were mobilizing around the inequality and, you know, how much people are, they're spreading out the wealth. I would say that that's some of my scholarship. I think that's really the big, big issue, but it's really hard. You know, they vote against their own interests. You know, they believe that people who are in positions of power and wealthy really, really are supportive of them. And yet it's very difficult to get them to see that they vote against their own interests. And they don't understand that there are policies that are basically being established that goes against their interests.
One of the roles that I think a teacher plays, I truly believe that I was talking to your colleague, Dr. Ward, and she said, this may be a moment at which real change happens, but we need a leader. Anybody who is in a position of affecting people's lives as directly as a college professor is a leader. Were you attracted to teaching? You said you're an activist. Do you regard teaching as an outlet for your desire to see social change?
I have an obligation to affect change, at least in order to improve or inform students. And I take that role very seriously. You know, I'm also a member of the military. I retired 31 years in the military. One of the socialization of all military people who wear the uniform is about character. And I think that's where, you know, when you talk about leadership, I feel like, you know, one of the ideas that I put in my syllabi is training for leadership. And I think we need to train our young future generation to be good leaders and have good character. Personally, I think when we look at the character of our leadership and, you know, all the different levels, it varies. And I think what we really need, and this is another part of where we are in society, you know, it's about voting for character. You have to always ask yourself, is the person, the man or the woman that's going to be in this position, do they have good character? Can you trust this person with your children? do you believe that this person will do the right thing in the wee hours of the morning when they're struggling with a very, very tough decision? You would want somebody with in that position of power, in that position of authority, with good character. And, you know, being a part of the military, which was a, my training, was I always was impressed with my leaders because they always, I think I met many of them that had good character. And when we saw leaders who had flawed character, we had a way of removing those bad apples, removing them from command. And I see that on campus, and I see myself as a person who, you know, I know when I get up in front of that class, I lead by example. So I expect them to follow me, and I don't expect them to follow me when I got bad character. And anybody that's in a position of authority, anybody that's in a position of power, have to make sure that they have good character. And we don't want people who will abuse that power. And that's, I think, and that's where I think a lot of that frustration that we see out on the streets protesting is an example of that too. I think people are witnessing, they see things that happen in the church. I think they see things that happen in school systems. I see that see things that happen where, you know, members of the profession, they do not police each other. And that's where we have to do a better job, because I think that message, when we tell our next generation of children that people in positions of power and authority can get away with doing that have flawed character, and we tolerate it, that's problematic.
Dr. Darrell Walsh is a professor of sociology here at UTC.